Thanks again to Lou Elizondo for being here. You know, Lou is a guy who always chooses his words carefully. But if you were listening closely to what he told us, I mean, he dropped some pretty major Easter eggs there. Might take a little while for it to sink in, what he just told us and shared with us. But I think the audience will be able to figure it out in the next day or so if they listen to the program again. We move on now. Paul Stonehill, one of my favorite guests on this program, is an international researcher and author whose area of specialty includes UFOs, USOs, that is, unidentified submersible objects, Soviet space exploration, Eurasian paranormal phenomena. He produces these terrifically entertaining videos for his YouTube page covering a broad spectrum of the subjects that we love here on Coast to Coast. He's co-authored a recent book with Philip Mantle called Russia's USO Secrets, Unidentified Submersible Objects in Russian and International Waters. It's one of the topics we'll cover tonight, but we'll also be digging into the Dyatlov Pass incident, the search for Shambhala, a ghost town of the Urals, and a lot of other cool stuff that's unique content that only Paul produces. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. The revelations that Lou Elizondo helped to bring to public attention about these unknown craft, UAPs, UFOs, whatever you want to call them, interacting with American military units, flying around over sensitive locations such as nuclear missile bases, and flying and zipping around in the water, have made it all the more relevant to dig into the topic of USOs. And if you wonder if they're happening here, are they happening everywhere else? And the answer is yes. Paul Stonehill has dug into it in a new book called Russia's USO Secrets. Among other things, he explores what Vladimir Putin knows and has said about UFOs. Paul, great to have you back on the program.
Thank you for inviting me. Glad to be here.
I think we'll save the USO part of it, the discussion, for hour two. And in this one, I want to get into some of the more exotic mysteries that you've explored. The idea of Shambhala existing, you know, forever. People know about this mystical, magical land of peace and wisdom, it's supposed to be in Tibet. You explore the idea that maybe Shambhala is in Siberia. Tell the story.
Well, you know, in Central Asia, for example, everything connected to Shambhala is like an object of reverence and pride. And in the Russian territories, so to say, Slavic Russian territories, among the Kazakhs of the Don, Urals, Altai, and Transbaikal, it's known as Belavodya, or White Waters. You know, in India, it was called Kalapa. There are other names like Shveta Dvipu, Tebu. Anyway, in the Slavic lands, people believed in it in a long time. It was like a utopia idea where you could escape and have a wonderful life, you know, good nature, good everything. So people did try to get there. And we have historical records that some actually were successful. Like in the ancient days of the Prince Vladimir, there was a monk who studied in the Byzantine Empire and probably picked up a few things because they had excellent espionage system, spies all over. Anyway, he convinced the prince to send him to the this land of white waters, Belavodya. He left in 1987, and he took a company of military warriors with him. And he came back, but nobody expected him. The prince died a long time ago, and he brought with him tales, very unusual tales. The only thing is that according to the chronicles, still kept in a monastery in Russia, he didn't age. He stayed in Kiev for a while, talked to some old-timers, one or two who were left alive, still remembered him, and he went back. And ever since, the Russians were fascinated with this idea and tried to get there. Now, there are different sites for the Shambhala in Russian perception. One is in the Altai Mountains, very interesting place. And people also say that one of the entrances to the Shambhala is out there in the Altai Mountains. But also people from the Altai Mountains were looking for Shambhala, so they looked eastward. And it wasn't just this organized popular movement. There were also Russian military officers involved and special travelers like Brzezinski, well-known. in the area who 18 years of his life he dedicated to the study of Central Asia. And still, even up today, some of the materials left by him and his comrade, Kozlov, they are still classified. This is very interesting. I know that Dalai Lama would not let Kozlov enter Lhasa in Tibet. Nevertheless, what I know from my research is that everything points out to the Gobi Desert areas, and that there are dead cities found, the dead sands out there. Russians discovered a lot, but from everything, it looks like there are underground cities in Mongolia, in the Gobi Desert especially, and some of them extend to northwestern China as well. Now, some believe that Russian Shambhala is actually a lake in European part of Russia called Svetlaya Yar, where a city disappeared during the Mongol invasion, in the 1300s. And sometimes people can hear and see strange sounds and visions of that city coming from the waters. It's a lot of spiritual stuff, but they do see UFOs once in a while in the area. There is no organized search, but it's a Russian belief, mystical belief, that yes, the city of Kitish was saved by disappearing in the waters of the lake. Some even say it may be an Atlantis. Oh, it's part of the Atlantis of Russia. I also have stories of Soviet military people who have seen strange underwater ruins in the Kuril Islands area, which is fascinating. And we'll speak about it later when we talk about USOs.
You think Shambhala is a physical location? Because I know reading, what the Tibetan monks have said, they think it's like a destination for an inner journey, something you do spiritually inside. But in one of your videos, you mentioned that there was a 2007 archaeological expedition that found some remnants or some kind of evidence.
You're talking about the fortress of Por Bajin in the island, small island, in the middle of the Lake of Tere, which is in the southern Siberia Altai Mountains, located near the Mongolian border again. It's been known, it was discovered in the 18th century, and there were some reports, but nobody knows why it was built, when exactly it was built. They think in the 8th century, how it was destroyed. There was no actually clues to any presence of human life there. Somebody built it, and then it was burned and destroyed. So they think it was part of the religious fortress at the time. Manichaeism was the religion. But again, we don't really know what's going on. Local people believe that yes, it's the site of the entrance, northern entrance to Shambhala, and there is even a small village called Shambhalig that's in the area, and of course they're using it to the fullest. But there are beliefs that yes, this may be a Shambhala, entrance to Shambhala, not from the Russian Academy of Sciences, but other people who have traveled there. So I don't think how that fortress will stay more than 80 years as it is, because of the melting ice, permafrost. That's where the soil is. So I hope we can save it and find out what's going on. But it's an eerie place. It's a beautiful area, but nobody knows who built it and why.
Another eerie place is in the Urals, in the Ural Mountains. It's what you call a ghost village. I guess it's the same general area where the Dyatlov Pass incident occurred, and we'll get back to that. But this story about this ghost village is really creepy. So can you give us the basics?
Yeah. By the year of 1977, 120 people who resided there disappeared. Like sometimes you see stories of ships that are found without any people on board. In this village, when after the people disappeared, those who came later, their neighbors, to look for them, some months later, they found out that there was food on the table. It's like daily life was interrupted, and everyone vanished without a reason, without any explanation. The furniture, everything was there. Not the cemetery was unfortunately not left intact. Graves were dug out and parts of bodies lying around, but this was done by local former criminals who had a colony, and they wanted to find gold because this, you know, years before, this was an area where people could find gold and produce gold for the state. But, you know, there was no more gold. What was in the place, what was seen above this place quite often, were strange objects flying around and pillars of light. There were a lot of strange things that people really did not want to talk about, but they knew what was happening, including, this is really strange, in the river by this village, before the World War II, a strange creature appeared, and the songs that, it's like siren songs that it sang, and locals heard it, listened to them. But what's interesting is this was like, they listened to it as an advice, because in those songs, sometimes they heard things that helped them. For example, they bought a lot of provisions just before the war. It's like somebody told them, you know, go and stack up. So what else is interesting about this village is that you cannot always find it, because sometimes its parameters, its geographical location changes. There were some small expeditions, scientists, and they couldn't find it. But, on other occasions, yeah, people would find out whatever remains of this village. And it's not a lot. Today, there is not a lot. I would say just an old field with dilapidated structures, maybe like three houses left, and that cemetery. Very strange place of this Rastes village. And, yeah, it's not that far away from the site where the mountaineers perished.
This village, I mean, it's so creepy. Some of the things that happened there kind of remind me of Skinwalker Ranch. It's all kinds of different phenomena. The people vanished, but they left their animals behind. I mean, their doors and windows are open, but the people are all gone. The animals are like they haven't been fed in a while, right?
Yeah, and you know, locals, you know, it's a faraway place, so locals talk to each other. There are villages, 10, 15, 20 kilometers away, but they've not received any news, so they went, in any way they could, they got to the village, and they found out that everything was like it should be, like every day, but the houses were left untouched, and animals were where they should be. I don't know what they were eating, but they were still there. Maybe somebody was feeding them. Windows were open, doors unlocked, nothing was stolen. They could find dishes of food with, you know, still on tables. Of course, you couldn't eat that food, but yeah, it was there. So, very unusual place. There are some expeditions that go there. It's not easy to get there. They use quadricycles and other machines, but it's the Ural Mountains. Strange things have happened there for thousands of years.
I know you've said that some groups have reached the place, and then as you recount the story in your video, they go there and they never want to come back, that something spooks them.
Most don't want to come back. They have a very bad feeling about it. It's in the atmosphere. It permeates them. It's like Stephen King or Lovecraft stories in a way. Yeah, people don't feel comfortable. I mean, just to drive by in an all-terrain vehicle, that's something else. But to go and stay there, nobody wants to do it. It's like one of those places that pushes you away.
And has there ever been like a formal government-type investigation of what happened there?
Well, the bureaucratic, the village was written off as non-suitable for further living. I remember reading the official documents, and they just closed it off. They said villagers left to other places, and that's where we are. I haven't heard from that they found villagers who have left to other places. I've not heard anybody in the Russian research who actually found somebody from that village anywhere. You know, But again, this is it's bureaucracy. Just they closed it off and, you know, continued on.
How far is it?
20 people, who cares about them, you know?
How far is it from Dyatlov Pass, and is there some kind of relationship? Is it
well, it's in the same region, but it's to the south. The Dyatlov Pass is more like polar Ural Mountains to the north. I don't want to say there is no relationship, because this is Ural Mountains. Strange things happen. We have stories of people who have left and live in the bowels of the earth, the strange tribes of advanced people, dwarf-like creatures, usually they're called, and also known in this area. But that's a completely different research. However, Ural Mountains are known for the legends of unusual animals, unusual beings, and of course UFOs for centuries. I have reports from the Russian Imperial Police, the gendarmes, and objects they've seen over the Orenburg area and so forth in the Ural Mountains, which they had to collect, and they couldn't understand what it was, but you know, there are official government reports from the days of the Empire.
You posted an update on Dyatlov, that there was some kind of a development earlier this year. Can you fill us in on what the latest news is?
The development is that the government is trying to shut down this case again using the investigative arm of the, they decided to say that, well, we looked at all the evidence and it's the avalanche that killed them, and, you know, people started laughing. Russian people are laughing, those who know what's going on, because the avalanche doesn't put radiation traces on somebody's body, and that's what they found out. And the avalanche doesn't eliminate somebody's tongue or parts of faces. So, it's the usual explanation. What we don't know is, you know, avalanche would not really destroy bones and tissues inside the bodies of those dead, mountaineers, and create deformation. So the Russian, the prosecutor general's office conducted verification of the investigation, but did not come out with anything. So we were even wondering why did they have to do it? Yeah, we were trying to find out what happened, but nobody wants to give explanation. I mean, we had a good chance when Yeltsin was in power, but he refused. Because, by the way, he's from that area when he was a young Communist Party member and so forth. That's where he operated too, Sverdlovsk area. Anyway, we don't know. We just don't know. Was it through the missiles? What's going on? Were they killed by the KGB operators? But you see, the group itself did not have a very clear background, so to say. Some of them, like Zolotarev, nobody really knows who he was. Most likely he was a Soviet, I don't want to say KGB, but I want to say military intelligence operative. For some reason he was in that group. He was the oldest. Still, it's a secret. I'm working on, I've got piles of materials to go through, investigations that take place still up to date, very interesting ones, but like newspapers like Komsomolskaya Pravda too. We're finding out that there were military intelligence, military investigators, very well professionally prepared, among the first searchers for this group.
We got to take a break. Paul Stonehill talking about Russia's USO secrets and other strange incidents. Have you ever wondered what Russia's supreme leader, Vlad Putin, thinks about the UFO topic? Well, Paul Stonehill has a piece about it on his YouTube channel. We're going to hear about it right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Stonehill, we had Lou Elizondo in the first half of the program, but of course got into Tic Tac and Gimbal, these UFO videos that are so widely distributed around the world and first reported by the New York Times. Do you have a sense of how that news went over in Russia? And I ask it in this context, in my visits to Russia in the 90s, the public didn't seem to know what to think about UFOs. They'd been told for so long by the government that this is not worthy of study. It's a Western plot. It's disinformation. And then the political changes opened up the country. There was a window of opportunity there where it was freely discussed. And then the political changes happened again the other way. And I just wonder if they think it's credible and how that news went over in Russia. Do you know?
With great interest from people who count, so to say, from the FSB or KGB people. At the top, they are very interested, not too much criticism, understanding of what's going on. You know, some people, of course, said, well, this is a ploy for the military, U.S. military, to get more money from the government. But again, people who count were quite serious. And we'll get into this research. But I want to tell you about, I think it's important to know what Putin said about UFOs. And what's going on with this? Back in 1990, well, my acquaintance since 1991, Vladimir Lagovsky, he's the editor of the prestigious Russian newspaper, Komsomolskaya Pravda, and they're very well connected. In 2005, when Putin was first time president, he had a chance to ask him, in front of other people, Vladimir Vladimirovich, I want to ask about aliens. And, let me know. And Putin was not too excited, but he says, okay, I'll let you know. Ever since our country has had presidents, there have been a legend that every new elected head of the country is privy to some terrible secret. It is that the Earth is visited by aliens. That is, the Americans take their presidents allegedly to a certain green room in which the frozen bodies of extraterrestrials are stored. To see, to make sure that we're not alone in the universe. Are you privy to this, Vladimir Putin? And Putin says, well, you know what? I was in the United States, and the president did not take me to any green rooms. I can assure you that I have never been privy to any secrets of this kind. Everything related to UFOs, such a topic, does not exist at the government level, at the level of the president. This is what he said in 2005. In 2012, Russia had another president, if you can call him that.
Medvedev,
Medvedev. And he revealed something else. He was joking, but I understand this Russian humor. But at the same time, he was sending signal to somebody saying, yes, when I became a president, I immediately was given this case with codes and information about aliens and so forth. So everything changed, and of course this is when Obama, this was just before Obama, told him that he's going to be very flexible with the Russians. So I'd like to know what Obama knows, but this is the situation in Russia. You never hear exactly what's going on, but at the same time they're very serious. It's not like the time when you were in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, and brought excellent materials out. It's different. It's more organized, more professional, more deadly, so to say, more focused. And the people who are involved in UFO research, unlike the Soviet times, it's at higher levels. You're speaking about the Mozhaisky Academy graduates, the brightest among Russian intelligence. They go into GRU, by the way, and the space intelligence and other forms of government and the space forces, which existed in the Soviet Union and now Russia since late 1960s, and they study UFOs, except we don't hear too much about it, almost nothing. But once in a while, we hear things, and not everybody likes this academy, but that's another story.
You think that there was something in the wording, the words that Putin used, that he was very careful in how he answered that question? Which, by the way, that's a very brave journalist to ask Vlad Putin that question in front of a group of people.
But Lagovsky, I think, also understands what he can ask, what not. But still, Putin is not somebody to toy with. Yes, I think that the words that he used, presidential level and so forth, it indicates, there is knowledge, but it may be at some some meaning that it's fluid, it escapes us. But he did not say there are no aliens or there is no information like that. He just indicated the levels. And it may be that they don't, that at some point they don't want to know. I am not sure. I know that Putin knows everything he needs to know. And by the way, even with my research of the Lake Baikal and the strange swimmers that they cited back in 1982, Putin went and to Lake Baikal in 2009. And he descended down to the bottom of Lake Baikal in a special apparatus because he knows also something is going on. He knows everything that he needs. You know, look at the Arctic areas. Putin is fortifying them. He's putting so much money into it. And this is one of the highest and most important areas of UFO and USO. Even that submarine that perished last year with the top Russian Navy scientists on a mission which we still don't understand in the Barents Sea, you know, they were taken away. They didn't lose as many people in high command during World War II as they did in one day in that area of the Arctic. So I think Putin is quite knowledgeable about what's going on, what's facing him, the threats to the borders of Russia. And, you know, it's a tough neighborhood that he lives in.
You know, speaking with Senator Harry Reid here, who had when he sponsored the program that became ATIP, he said he did so in part because he believed that the Russians and the Chinese were both trying to study this issue to figure out the technology. It's the same thing I was told in the 90s that they were, that the scientists at the Ministry of Defense who were investigating this were trying to figure out to get a technological advantage over the Americans. I wonder if you have any insight into what's going on there now. Do they have materials from crashes that our government believes they do? Do you have any independent information to confirm that?
1978, they were able to shoot something down in the Central Asia area, and they used it to reverse engineer their missiles. And I have videos on that, and it's in my books, too, in the in not far from the area of their testing, of their secret testing site for missiles, which is still they're still leasing it from Kazakhstan today. What's going on today? I can tell you what on December 12th, Minister of Defense of the Russian Federation Sergei Shoigu and the Minister of Defense of People's Republic of China Wei Fungi, they signed a protocol extension of the agreement between two governments. Notifications of launches of ballistic missiles and space missile carriers. What they do is that they don't want to interfere with each other's research, and they notify each other on what's going on. And I don't think it extends to Chinese expansion into outer space and, you know, visitations of the moon and their own program of space militarization. Nevertheless, they respect each other and they exchange opinions. I am not sure whether still it goes on the level of the United States and Russia, but from my understanding, at the very highest levels, there is no conflict. I think the information at the highest levels is being exchanged because it's too serious. And you could see cooperation when necessary. Even in the days of the old Soviet Union under Gorbachev, when the Phobos mission was sent to the moonlet of Mars, it was basically an international endeavor, but they didn't want to show it as such. So it was like a Soviet mission, but the Americans were on it every day, every second. And the Europeans, too, who helped build this spacecraft. So when it comes to, in my opinion, to the threat to our planet from the forces out there, as some of the American astronauts could confirm, we will work together.
That Phobos satellite that you're talking about, can you explain that story a little bit for our listeners who may not know how that mission ended up? It was very strange.
Moonlet of Mars is Phobos and Deimos. There are two moonlets. Most likely they're artificial creations. And they were discovered in 1876 by an American astronomer, but even before then, apparently we knew about them, because in Gulliver's Travels they were described, the two satellites. You know, that's what we're looking at, 18th century. Anyway, and I have proved that even there is a map in Armenia that shows Mars and one of the satellites. Anyway, what happened is that the Soviets sent a mission to Mars, two probes, two spacecraft. One was lost in September on the way to Mars, and the other one arrived, Phobos 2, and it was operating in the area of the Martian moonland. Phobos, very unusual space body. Your listeners can look up themselves. They can look on my channel or elsewhere. It's very unusual body. Looks like it's artificially created, has strange tracks on it, and so forth. And the Soviet probe was lost, but just before it was lost, it took a picture of a gigantic cigar-shaped 25-kilometer-long body next to it. And we don't think it was really destroyed. It was thinned out of the orbit, and there were rumors, very interesting rumors, that 2 months later it sent signals wherever it was, and then it shut down forever. We don't know what happened to it. But this space probe, Phobos, Phobos 2 was to take samples from the soil of Phobos and also use onboard laser to do other experiments. And whoever was there did not like it, and that's what one of the American astronauts,
Buzz Aldrin.
Yeah, he talked about monolith. He knows. He says there is a monolith on that little moonlet. And I met Marina Popovich also in 1991. She gave me the photograph of this object. We talked quite a lot when she was alive at that time. And she told me that Glavkosmos, which is the Soviet space agency, knew that something was going on there. And then I did a whole analysis with Dr. Richard Haynes. We had Soviet newspapers, military newspapers, and others. We had the day-by-day analysis, and Soviet scientists talked about this destruction of the Phobos 2 and that aliens probably pulled it away. It was one of the military professionals who said it. And there were a swarm of bodies around this space probe just before it was killed, also small bodies. I'm not talking about that gigantic object. It's like a mothership that emitted smaller objects around it. It was a very unusual case. And ever since, our governments, not just here, not just in the United States, are trying to get back. In 2011, there was a joint Russian-Chinese expedition which went nowhere. But I tell you, in a few years, you will see European and American and Russian expedition to Phobos. And I mention it in my videos, too, because they want to get there. They know there is something. And Burdakov, I had a good acquaintance, Professor Burdakov, one of the top Soviet scientists.
Yeah, I met him.
He knew that something was going on, and he was raising hell.
Well, whatever is there doesn't seem to want to have its picture taken, because, I mean, it seems like every probe that's been sent there, I'm trying to remember, but there's been more than two, right? It seems like everything that's been sent there, something happens to it.
Yeah, to Mars, for sure. And, yeah, you know, the Soviets lost their spacecraft, Americans lost their spacecraft. We don't know what the pictures we're getting from Mars, We're not sure if we're shown everything that's going on. And I'm sure when China goes there, they'll have their own pictures. I just don't think they'll share with anybody else. But it seems they'll get there. There are two very interesting planets, for sure. It's Venus, that should be explored. I just don't know we have resources or money for it, and Mars. And we are not presented with full information that our governments know, of course, about Mars. But enough. There has been enough disclosure, maybe not voluntarily, to know that there is something there. And the two moonlets, definitely creations, of artificial creations, are operating by Mars. Maybe there are two sentinels that are guarding Mars. from something. And I want to tell you something. In one of the videos, and I presented this information, NASA published translation of a book by a Soviet scientist, one of those involved in the Mars program, who mentioned that there are dead cities on Mars. He mentioned in the sands of Mars there are dead cities. He didn't talk too much, but they translated it to the hilt, and they had made no comments. They used, you know, American taxpayers' money to translate this book, and NASA did not make a comment. It was an excellent book about Mars exploration, Soviet experience. And he's still alive, that gentleman, very elderly now. And, you know, so things happen. Something is going on.
Do you know if Budakov is still alive?
No. No, Budakov passed away, I think, in 2013, and I wrote about it. This was an unusual personality. And first of all, when he was young, he was speaking about UFOs under Stalin, and he suffered for it, but he was protected by Korolev, who said, you know what, I'll banish you. And he put him in the Pulkovo Observatory. That's where people send reports about UFOs. They had nowhere else to send. So Burdakov was outspoken. He was very much involved in the Soviet missile development and space exploration program. He worked in the design bureau of Korolev. And he is the guy, I told you years ago, that he is the guy that had a he told the story of the microchip that was shown to the Soviet top academicians in early 1950s. They didn't know what it was. At that time, they couldn't give an assessment. Where did that microchip come from? He wanted to know, too. Burdakov was more than that. He is the guy that promoted idea with another Soviet scientist that comets are actually interplanetary travel mechanisms used by extraterrestrial civilizations because it's one of the best ways to travel among stars. And I think we saw this not long ago, an object that came into our...
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Burdakov was more than that. Well, I want to finish with something quickly about him.
We're going to have to take a break. Hold on. We'll come back to this, I promise, because I'd like to hear more. And Burdakov, yeah. We interviewed him on camera. He was a wonderful resource for us and a very helpful and insightful guy. And Korolev, the father of the Soviet space program, was his mentor. We're coming back with Paul Stonehill to talk about Russia's USO secrets in addition to UFO secrets. We'll be right back with more.